I want to welcome you to session 501, More Product, Less Process. This is More Product, Less Process, MPLP Revisited, Choosing the Right Processing Strategy for Your Repository and Collections. So be sure you're in the right place this morning. The 2005 publication of Mark Green and Dennis Meisner's article, More Product, Less Process, Revamping Traditional Archival Processing, by the American Archivist, generated one of the most popular topics for annual meeting program proposals for the last 4 years. We have gone from the general to the specific, from traditional collections MPLP processing to applying MPLP to the latest postcard collection. The implementation of minimal processing strategies to reduce backlog and make more collections accessible faster has become widely accepted and continues to gain momentum. Yes, the application of minimal processing has been widely discussed by our profession, but have we really examined MPLP's attributes as the processing standard, a status it appears to have achieved very quickly? Growing backlogs and dwindling resources are dilemmas that we live with daily. Is it natural that MPLP would generate genuine enthusiasm as a solution? As the dust settles, we're now hearing more grave misgivings among some of the SAA membership. Some are finding that the answers provided by MPLP often require compromises that run counter to established processing and access standards and guidelines. For some archivists, questions concerning appraisal, acquisition, preservation, reference and access, security donor relations, and even the role of the archivist remain. Is MPLP the standard processing methodology in all situations? Is it the standard processing strategy or the right processing strategy for your repository and collections? Today's session, Revisiting MPLP, directly addresses the need to build sustainable archives through use of appropriate processing practices. Practices that will ensure we continue to meet the needs of users, donors, and archivists. Our panel will present the concerns of two archivists, Jeff Sahanek and Laurie Schwartz, about MPLP and the implementation of minimal processing practices. And our third archivist, MPLP co-author Dennis Meisner, will respond with his thoughts on the direction archivists should be taking in considering and revamping processing practices. Our panelists will talk for about 10 minutes each, and then we will have plenty of time, I hope, for discussion, because we have only a one-hour session. First, I want to ask the audience to have some idea of who is here this morning. How many of you are applying MPLP almost universally in your repositories? Okay. And who of you have some concerns about MPLP but have not found those concerns addressed at SAA annual meetings in the last 4 years? So we have some people with concerns. Okay. I mean, why are you here this morning? and would any of you like some fresh insight from our authors of MPLP? I see a lot of hands there. Okay. And then out of curiosity, I would like to know how many in the audience have less than 5 years processing experience?
Okay, that's a good number. And so go ahead and just raise your hands for more than that, just so we raise them high so we can just sort of see. Okay, it's a nice split on that. Well, to discuss our issues today, Jeff Sahanek began his work in archives in 1982 at the Ohio Historical Society and is now head of public policy archives at the University of Kentucky Libraries, where he has been since 1988. In addition to the public policy archives, Jeff was previously the director of the Louis B. Nunn Center for Oral History at the University of Kentucky. He is co-author of Time on Target, the World War II memoir of William R. Buster. In the Society of American Archivists, he served as chair of Congressional Papers Roundtable, chair of the Oral History Section, and is currently serving as a member of the Education Committee. Lori Swartz is Special Projects Archivist at South Carolina Political Collections of the University of South Carolina. Her most time-consuming special project has been processing of Senator Ernest Holling's papers, the provision of reference to the retired senator, and digitization of a small segment of his collection. She is newly elected to the steering committee of SAA's Congressional Papers Roundtable and is active in her state library and archival associations. Lori and her colleague, Dorothy Hazelrigg, are currently working on final revisions to MPLP Revisited and Alternate Viewpoint, which has been accepted for publication in the American Archivist. She holds an MA in Public History and an MLIS from the University of South Carolina. And Lori, tell me, that article is going to be in a special issue on MPLP, is that correct?
It's going to have several, I guess, MPLP.
Okay, there will be several other articles on MPLP in that issue, so be looking for that this coming year. Dennis Meisner is head of collections management at the Minnesota Historical Society and an SAA fellow. Most of his archival career is focused on the arrangement and description of archival materials, including their discovery and use in networked environments. He has participated in a number of SAA and international efforts to that end and presently serves on SAA's Encoded Archival Content Working Group. In 2003-2004, of course, he collaborated with Mark Green on the NHPRC-funded More Product, Less Process project, which has fueled his current reputation, as he says, as one of the bad people. Those are Dennis's words. So I now open the floor to our panel, and Jeff will be speaking first.
Thanks, Cheryl. Can you all hear me?
No.
How about now? Is that better? Well, good, way too early in the morning to all of you. Thank you for coming this morning. Some of you are here by choice, others by coercion. I'll just begin by stating that the idea for this session here today has come about as a result of what I've seen and heard over the last 3 to 4 years at SAA annual meetings, as well as regional and state archives meetings regarding the adoption and implementation of, by many repositories, of More Product, Less Processing, or MPLP for short, as a processing strategy, and as a result of my work on SAA's Education Committee. Last year, my first on the committee, I was somewhat taken aback that an MPLP workshop was being approved to be offered for the first time at the San Francisco annual meeting. When I and another member of the committee objected on the grounds that an SAA-sponsored workshop is tantamount to an SAA stamp of approval, and that to my recollection, MPLP as a processing strategy had not had what I considered a thorough airing among the membership, the consensus around the table was, what about MPLP is there to discuss? Let me be clear. I think that this discussion is long overdue, perhaps so much so that, in my opinion, the current trend is probably irreversible. But I think this needs to be said, and in my opinion, we should have had a full-fledged discussion about MPLP as a processing strategy 2 or 3 years ago. As I've listened to presentations at SAA, regional, and state archives meetings over the last 3 to 4 years, I've heard many archivists extol the virtues of utilizing MPLP as a processing strategy for their collections. Indeed, that by implementing MPLP, they've opened up hundreds, if not thousands, of their previously inaccessible collections to researchers. Now, let me be clear once again. I am not against MPLP as a processing strategy. Where appropriate, we all have those kinds of collections, a scrapbook collection of a Hollywood movie star compiled during the 1950s, consisting of newspaper or magazine clippings of no real value. Using MPLP on this kind of collection is appropriate in my view. University archives is another place where I believe the selective and limited use of MPLP makes sense. However, from what I've been hearing over the last 3 to 4 years, many repositories have indiscriminately used MPLP as a processing standard without regard to the nature or value of the collections. Let me be clear again. I get it. I think Mark Green and Dennis Meisner, in their article on more product, less processing, were honestly trying to present a sound strategy for dealing with increasingly large backlogs and dwindling financial and human resources faced by many, if not most, repositories. But in my opinion, the execution of the MPLP theory by various repositories was and is flawed, from what I've heard at many annual meetings and conferences, both large and small, and is, I hope, not what Mark and Dennis intended. So I'd like to take this opportunity this morning to talk about some of the grave concerns I have about MPLP, but even more importantly, I want to talk about what we are losing or are about to lose in the profession as MPLP becomes the standard for processing collections. First, a stated goal of MPLP is to make more collections accessible faster, thereby reducing institutional backlogs and material costs while at the same time making researchers happier. In the short term, the part about making collections accessible faster and reducing backlogs and material costs is certainly true. Lori and I contend that the other part about making researchers happier might not be as accurate as it appears at first glance, and she will address this issue in her presentation. Regarding making collections accessible faster while reducing backlogs and material costs, I would contend that by taking the time to arrange, describe, and process collections properly and to current accepted standards, we ensure greater access over time. Archives are not McDonald's franchises with drive-through windows. We should not discard time-tested arrangement, description, and preservation methodologies for the sake of expediency. I contend that one of our professional mandates is to ensure that the materials in our collections are accessible to researchers as fast as possible without compromising the long-term survivability of that material. Mark and Dennis argued in their article that access should override long-term preservation concerns. It is our belief, which is supported by Article 8, titled Security and Protection under the Code of Ethics for Archivists, that access versus preservation should not be mutually exclusive concerns, but are co-equal responsibilities of an archivist. If your repository has adopted MPLP as your processing standard, you are leaving ticking preservation time bombs for those archivists who follow you. I don't believe they and future researchers will think we did them any favors. To sum up this section of my presentation, I will throw out the outlandish thought that backlogs don't matter as much as we think. In my opinion, the answer to backlogs lies not in crudely or minimally processing collections, much like a MASH unit attends to wounded soldiers, but rather in another, much dwelled upon, but widely neglected in practice, archival process that segues to my second point. MPLP does not do anything to improve an institution's appraisal practices or collecting policy, but instead serves to ensure the continued collecting and accessioning of collections of dubious historical and research value. If you don't have to invest a lot of human and material resources into arranging, describing, processing, and preserving those collections, you don't have to put much thought into what you collect and why. So in my view, rather than helping to alleviate repository backlogs, MPLP has the potential to actually increase backlogs. Mark Green has spent much of his career giving workshops on the art of collecting and appraisal, and I know he continues to preach the absolute necessity of applying sound appraisal and collecting policy guidelines. I know that he and I both share a belief in retrospective appraisals of unprocessed collections to determine if they still fit in a repository's collecting policy. Cultural property theft has always been a problem and concern for libraries and archival repositories. SAA offers a workshop in security, and I'm sure ALA does as well. If MPLP is a repository's processing standard, how can the archivist possibly know what is missing or has been stolen from a collection if he or she never knew it was there in the first place. Just log on to eBay sometime and do a search utilizing the names of some of your collections. Did those items come from one of your collections, or did someone just get lucky at a garage sale or a flea market? Theft from our collections is a reality today, and cynics will say it's impossible to stop cultural heritage thieves if they really want to steal something from one of your collections. That may well be true, but you have a lot better chance of stopping them, or at least recovering the item if the perpetrator is ever discovered, if you knew it was in your collection to begin with. Libraries commit a lot of resources to prevent books from being stolen from their bookshelves, books that in most cases can be easily replaced. Why would archivists be less concerned with the security of one-of-a-kind, far more valuable material that is not replaceable? It makes no sense. It is my belief that adopting MPLP as a processing standard will ultimately affect donor relations in a negative way. I'm of the opinion that when an administrator or archivist agrees to accept the collection, there is an implicit, if not written or verbal, commitment on the part of the repository's representative to take all necessary steps to preserve and protect that collection. If the administrator or archivist is not willing to make such a commitment, then the collection should not be accepted unless other unavoidable factors are involved. If valuable documents from a collection come up missing, I don't think a donor will take ignorance on the part of the archivist that the documents ever existed as a valid excuse. A donor should be told at the point of donation where that collection fits in the repository's processing priority list and why. But I think one of the most important things we lose when MPLP becomes a repository's processing standard is the irreplaceable bond that exists between the researcher and the archivist. Throughout the 20th century, researchers relied on and trusted the knowledge possessed by the institutional archivist. The researchers, more often than not total strangers, relied on us to guide them not only to the collections they requested, but to collections the researcher didn't even know existed that contained information germane to their research. Such knowledge was only gained by the archivist through much effort and the passing of time, by working intimately with collections, processing them folder by folder, arranging, describing, and preserving them, collection by collection, year after year. We, in many respects, were the gatekeepers to knowledge. And as archivists, that's what we live for. What a thrill to point researchers to collections they didn't know existed, to make links and connections to information only you, or at best a few of your fellow colleagues, could make and deliver. But I fear with MPLP being embraced by more and more repositories as a processing standard, this irreplaceable bond between researcher and archivist is being broken. As I recall, in a letter to the Midwest Archives Conference last year, Mark Green wrote that in the future, and I'll paraphrase, we will rely on researchers to tell us, the archivists, what is in our collections. This statement should be, in my opinion, anathema to the profession. If we are ready to accept that premise, then I believe the archival profession has been turned on its head, and we are headed for a seismic shift in the definition of what it means to be an archivist. And there is a solution to the ubiquitous problem of dwindling funds provided by our institutions, and it's called fundraising. Fundraising from private sources in the form of endowments has to become part and parcel of who we are and what we do as archivists. The fact is that we are never going to receive enough internal funding from our institutions to do what we need to do to protect, preserve, and make accessible current and future collections. Those institutions that are already raising money privately know the value of doing so. SAA offered a fundraising workshop earlier this week, and there was a session on Thursday regarding the subject. Fundraising is part science and part art, but it is not difficult once you learn how, and it can be very rewarding and can bring you the resources you need to properly process your collections while decreasing your backlog and making more of your collections accessible. Now, I intend to formally request that the SAA Standards Committee and the Committee on Ethics and Professional Conduct review the concept of more product, less processing, and issue opinions on whether or not MPLP meets generally accepted professional standards and fulfills archivist ethical and professional obligations as outlined in the SAA's Code of Ethics for Archivists. I believe that utilizing MPLP as a standard processing strategy is a sure way to lose both physical and intellectual control over your collections. We can't just blithely sacrifice legal and ethical responsibilities on the altar of access just because they're inconvenient and burdensome. MPLP is a far too simplistic attempt at a solution to a complex problem. So to conclude, I'll just say, I'm just saying.
Hello. Seems like this is working, yes? Okay. Confronting backlogs by adjusting the degree to which we process collections, an old idea that we can all agree on, including Green and Meisner, who dusted off this idea several years ago, reshaped it, and presented it anew as MPLP. Archivists everywhere have responded by eagerly embracing elements of MPLP, not as a last resort, but as a constructive standard. The judgment and prioritization that have always been a part of archivist work are now being described in terms of commitment to MPLP. Rather than accepting minimal processing as a cure-all, we need to consider whether it may, in some cases, do a disservice to researchers, collections, and our profession. And I'm going to focus on a few areas: sensitive material, researchers, and the future of our profession. Oh, sorry. I always talk softly, so yell if you can't hear me. As you know, collections often hide sensitive information that should be examined before being opened. This information may simply be something that a donor might wish to remain private, but there are many other types of sensitive information, as you know, some of which may come with consequences for improper release. Medical records of a donor's patients, you've heard this list before, legal or financial files of clients, academic records from a class a donor taught, opposition research, say from a political campaign, casework handled by public officials. We may request that true sensitive material be excluded from donations, but a donor may not have full awareness of the range of information considered sensitive. And trickier still, as you know, is classified material. It is found in a variety of papers, not just political papers, and in files that we'd never expect. And though we might assume that it might be prevented by some vague governmental safeguard from making its way into our collections, or that anything marked classified has long since been declassified, we would be wrong. In the last 5 years alone, we've heard stories of government officials visiting repositories and reviewing and redacting and confiscating materials, including mine in South Carolina. And while archivists have a professional commitment to open access to materials, that commitment is limited by an equal commitment to protect privacy rights and uphold laws. Even if legal and criminal liability for revealing this information is not relevant, archivists should be concerned about ethical liability. Even in processing to the folder or item level, we can't assure that we've noticed or understood the implications of the documents that we're looking at. In a broader minimal approach, we open ourselves up to questions about due diligence. Hopefully, we all realize that depending upon researchers to identify sensitive information to us is an unwise move. It is our responsibility as professionals to make informed decisions about which records may be made available. Let's move on to researchers. Under MPLP, researchers may have more access to more collections, but they might be finding less material of use. This should be unacceptable to those of us trained historians because we have personal experience in the difficulties of primary source research. And I would think this should dissatisfy trained librarians because our purpose, whether we're catalogers, reference librarians, or archivists, is to provide information efficiently. We might be content in believing researchers are making good use of our collections because they're getting to use more collections, but the problem is that use of a collection and good use of a collection, meaning productive use, are different outcomes. A speaker in Chicago 2 years ago at SAA noted that archivists at her repository now spend more time helping researchers navigate finding AIDS because the MPLP description resulted naturally in AIDS with differing formats. And she said that confusion by users was acceptable because they are happier to, quote, have a possibility of finding what they want, even if it requires plowing through numerous boxes, than to get no hits at all on their keyword search, end quote. I'd like to meet these researchers. And aren't they disappointed when the archivists on whom they rely for additional help lack familiarity with these minimally processed collections? Many researchers have traveled some distance. They may have hired assistants. They have funding limits. They have deadlines. They are trying to conduct their research efficiently. If archivists ignore these realities in the name of minimal processing, they could be doing damage to their repository's reputation and their own professional standing. And there is evidence to say that researchers prefer detailed, uniform finding aids. Another panelist, 2 years ago, spoke of surveying researchers at two universities and discovering, shockingly, that they did not like nonconformity among finding aids within one archive. They preferred detailed box lists, and they wanted context worked into the description wherever it was possible. And these practices wouldn't fit well with minimal processing, and I don't think they're asking for too much. Political scientists and historians speaking at past meetings of the Association of Centers for the Study of Congress indicated that greater detail in finding aid always aided their research. The more detail available to political scientists, for example, the more data they can produce, the more conclusions they can draw. Yet another presenter 2 years ago, it was a busy meeting, mused on the wheat-to-chaff ratio in congressional collections. He appreciated when archivists used finding aids to point out the unique material, but also to point out the items that would be least useful to them. In minimally processed collections, not only would the chaff remain, likely never to be weeded, but neither would the highly prized wheat be identified in finding aids, leaving researchers to sort through it all themselves. Recently, my repository hosted two researchers from California for a week of intense research into several collections. And because we placed detailed finding aids for all of our collections, all of our open collections online, the researchers felt comfortable in scheduling a week-long visit for an archive 3,000 miles away that they had never visited. From the folder list on our website, they knew a visit would be worthwhile and that the collections would not be filled with chaff. Let's move on to our profession. The enthusiasm for embracing minimal processing standards as a default has some troubling ramifications for our profession. As archivists, we have long fought to assert our status as professionals, and in many cases as academics, by emphasizing that our work requires in-depth research, scholarly writing, and specialized training. Minimal processing has caused some of us to turn away from doing the level of research and writing that had been considered in the past to be a minimum. As recently as 2000, Randall Jemerson described the efforts of the American archival community to improve its standards and outreach with an eye towards increasing professionalism. He identified three areas of emphasis: developing internal standards for professional recognition, enhancing the public image of archives and archivists, and strengthening the research and theoretical foundations of the profession. With MPLP, it appears that the attentions of many hoping to enhance the standing of archives have fixated on the bete noire of backlogs and how MPLP can help to resolve it. The impulse to improve has perhaps led to the widespread of MPLP. Ironically, however, the shortcuts many of us have put into place might serve instead to diminish the public image of archives and archivists and almost negate the importance of research to the profession. The archival world has always been prone to competing schools of thought, as in library science versus historical training, conflict over whether archival theory or practice is more important, etc. Such divergent viewpoints are part of what led Jemerson to ponder the crisis of professional identity on the part of archivists. However, if, as he suggests, uniform standards for archival work would be a positive development for the standing of the profession, it is important that MPLP be thoroughly debated. To be clear, there are circumstances where elements of MPLP are appropriate, but it must be applied judiciously. If we allow minimal processing to become codified in our profession, we are facilitating our own growing irrelevance. One inevitable result of indiscriminate adoption of MPLP is a devaluing of the archival profession, as most anyone can transcribe folder titles, create box lists, and provide the most basic reference. Archivists with faculty status in an academic setting must be wary of what happens when the production of scholarly work in the form of detailed finding aids disappears from our regular duties. We must all figure out how to remain relevant and maintain our profession as a profession worthy of an advanced degree. The eternal struggle of archivists to obtain greater resources and respect will not be well served by displacing some of our intellectual work onto researchers and even donors, the constituencies that we are supposed to serve and that are best able to help us. To wrap up, Jeff and I believe that what's needed in this discussion is data, both empirical and anecdotal. Someone, the Standards Committee, the Committee on Ethics and Professional Conduct, the Education Committee, a special task force, the manuscript section at SA, should conduct a broad survey to see what repositories are using MPLP, to what extent, how many have adopted it as their primary processing standard, and what researchers think of having access to more collections that have been minimally processed. And we know there are a few surveys out there in the works, but haven't seen the final results yet. Researchers are the reason repositories exist, and unless we have some hard data, we really can't pass judgment on MPLP as an effective methodology. Thanks.
Good morning, everybody. How's this? The volume okay? All right. We'll give this a try. I want to start out by thanking Lori and Jeff, and I really mean it, because a discussion is being engaged, which up until now has taken place in corridors and receptions, but never really made it front and center to audiences in sessions like this, and I hope a lot comes out of it. I think the calls for more data are good ones, and we need to go through these arguments and really assess their validity. Lori is absolutely correct in saying that the MPLP approach is not a cure-all, and I hope that there is nobody in this room that thinks that it is. There always have been, always will be, a number of situations in which the collections we are processing require detailed work in arrangement, in description, or both, even down to the level of item processing. The trick is knowing which ones they are. And I think the trick to that is understanding one's entire program, all the collections that are there, all the resources that are reasonably available into the foreseeable future, and then making choices based on that. I hope I'm not boring anybody with something that I say every time I speak about this topic, which is that MPLP fundamentally is not about processing actions or preservation and conservation actions. It's about resource management at a repository level. It's about understanding what you have, what you're likely to have, the work that needs to be done, and then adjusting things to make sure that that entire package gets taken care of, and that users, as the most important part of the equation, get served well in the process of doing those things. So I'd start off by saying that Jeff and Lori are absolutely right that there are reasonable concerns in areas of sensitive materials in archival collections, in a burden being added to the researchers using those collections, and perhaps even in the professional, the appearance of the professional standing of archivists. But I want to go back and run quickly through all three of those areas and give a little different perspective on it. Regarding sensitive materials in archival collections, I think that there are really three stakeholders involved in solving this problem: the donors of the material, the researchers, and the archivist in the middle. For a long, long time, archivists have assumed full responsibility for those sensitive materials. and have considered it their problem. I think that more responsibility needs to be ported off to the other two partners in that triangle, and we need to start changing our associational or professional culture so that we can accept that responsibility sharing. One thing that can help there is educating our users. And one example of something that's going on is the University of North Carolina's Southern Historical Collections. They, as a link to their online finding aids, and to some extent even embedded directly into the finding aids, is a sensitive material statement. I'm not sure it's there for all collections or only for collections that they suspect really have sensitive materials problems. But at any rate, it's a fairly extensive document that explains the nature of those materials, what they might be, where they might be found, and what the researcher's responsibility to them is in how they are used. I think we need to, by the same token, educate our donors much better than we have in the past. We should be preparing, again, extensive FAQ sheets describing potentially sensitive or legally compromising categories of materials that are likely to be in the materials they're donating. Clear statements about processing levels should also be applied so that there are no questions at the moment of acquisition about what these materials are and what is going to be done with them on the archives end. And I really do think that problematic material should be largely discovered during the acquisition phase and a mitigation plan developed during that phase of the archival cycle. We need to educate our reference providers better than we have. We need to establish good feedback loops for sensitive materials that are discovered during the use of collections. So again, we can apply mitigation in the areas where there's some real juice to the squeeze in providing mitigation. We need to accept, again, as part of a changing professional culture, that zero risk is not an acceptable real-world model. It isn't in government. It isn't in the business world. It shouldn't be in this profession either. We need to significantly elevate our tolerance to risk as archivists. We need to accept that we are not responsible for ideal outcomes for researchers, donors, even for our resource allocators. We are responsible for creating and applying reasonable processes so that all the parties in these transactions, and especially the researchers, come out with significant good, with significant benefit. I also think that from my experiences, and I think that this is true for Mark too, that legal and ethical vulnerabilities have been overstated. I think our principal ethical vulnerability occurs when we withhold access to materials that we have acquired, had for a great deal of time, have advertised our ownership of. This is a real area of vulnerability that we're not taking seriously enough, and I think we need to be frightened by the fact that that it does exist. And I think that we really need to investigate further this idea that we are in some way required to protect the reputation of any third party represented in the collections in our care. I don't think we've done a good enough job of picking apart either the code of ethics and the logic and experience that underlies it, nor have we sufficiently investigated what legal ramifications might be out there. But I suspect that we don't have the obligation that sometimes we believe we have. Now, another general area is the added burden for researchers. And indeed, we are, through techniques like this, through minimal or basic processing techniques, pushing back on our researchers and creating more expectations on their part. It's really a zero-sum game in which somebody always pays. And I think it's appropriate for users to share in those costs. Here again is a situation where archivists have assumed that they are solely responsible for all the costs in these transactions, and that ought not to be the case. We know from every other area of life that, given the choice, consumers want everything and they want it for free. In a landscape like ours that's dominated increasingly by resource scarcity, archivists must define reasonable limits. In other words, researchers have been living in a model, in a culture, where they expect free beer. I think in the future, they should be expecting free kittens. They're getting something, but they're taking on a burden, a cost, and a responsibility. And I think that we need to move to that sort of realization as the new normal. I also think it's really disingenuous to pretend that we've traditionally processed all of our collections in detail, especially large 20th century collections. I think when we have done so, we've made those sorts of decisions often enough accidentally. And the one thing that MPLP does is encourage us to strategically look at those things, to make the decision about which collections will be most usable or only adequately usable to researchers that in order to be that, they need to be processed in some detail. And by the same token, then deciding where that is not the case and applying much more minimal methodologies to those collections. And then regarding the professional eclipse of archivists, I think that the research and writing that has always informed our profession has nothing to do with arrangement and with finding aids. It has to do with studying the social values of information, the nature of archives, and the nature of their use. We shouldn't confuse those sorts of intellectual endeavors with processing, which is a whole different kettle of fish. We ought to be applying our professional intellects into understanding user behaviors, new finding aid models, appraisal theory, and a better understanding of creating entities, the entities that create archival materials, and our description of them. We habitually over-describe records and under-describe the creators of the records, and that needs to be brought back in balance. But these are just illustrations of very large questions where we ought to be applying ourselves. I don't think we should look at the arrangement and description of collections as being our principal intellectual endeavor. And just to close, it seems to me, and this is pure speculation, that the root of our worries isn't really legal actions. And I don't think it's the fear of ethical missteps. I think the root is psychological. It's in our own heads. I think archivists have, as a group, compared to the larger population, have strong needs for control, for security, and have low levels of risk tolerance. I think that's who we are as people, and that's part of getting into this sort of profession. I think we need to sort of get comfortable with that and bring that into the understanding of why we think we do about how we process our collections. And yes, indeed, we need data in all these areas. Obviously, I'm throwing out a lot of opinion, but you're seeing that I'm not backing it up with anything that looks like numbers or actual experiences. And I think that a lot of people in this room probably need to get going and start thinking about these sorts of things. I think there are some good studies to be done here, and we'll all benefit from their being carried out. So I'll close there, and thank you.
We have very little time for question and discussion, but I do want to give Jeff and Lori a chance to respond to Dennis's remarks before I open it up to the group, and I'll just ask them to be brief so we can allow some time for the group.
Cheryl, why don't we just go ahead and open up for discussion? I think that would...
Okay.
I'm sure there are a lot of questions out there.
All right. I see a question in the back. We are being recorded, so I will need to repeat your question. So if you'll please just identify yourself and ask your question, please, in the back over here.
I'm having trouble
hearing you. You may have to come forward a little bit. This is a big room.
Yes, I'm going to take that.
Let me interrupt just a minute and say this gentleman is from Princeton. He is the instructor for the MPLP workshop, and he was commenting on Dennis's remarks that he agreed with that a lot of this is in our heads, something we have to get over, and that at Princeton, where he works, their experience has been is that the user really does want access. They're willing to work with them on privacy and confidentiality issues. And they have also seen, since they've been doing this, they have seen an increase in use. And then he mentioned that the workshop is going to be offered in Kentucky. I guess so Jeff can take it.
Okay. If
I can sum up what he just wanted to add was that the comment Lori had made about the profession, he said that he felt that MPLP causes us to make decisions. And, of course, these are largely intellectual decisions, and it's a more professional action on our part and requires a certain amount of expertise to make these decisions. I think I've done that okay. Jeff, did you want to make a comment?
Yeah, I wanted to respond to both of his points. I knew that this question would come up. So with respect to this all being in our heads as far as legal and ethical vulnerabilities, I strongly disagree. The legal issues involving privacy laws, copyright, identity theft, cultural art theft, and classified documents and or homeland security are very real. Article 9 of SAA's Code of Ethics states that archivists must uphold all local, state, and federal laws. The Oral History Association has published an entire pamphlet titled Oral History and the Law. So in my mind, the responsibilities of an archivist is a four-legged stool. One leg is appraisal and acquisition. Another leg is indeed providing access to our collections. No question about that. But the other two are equally important legs, and those are preserving our collections not only for the here and now, but for future generations, as well as doing our best to legally protect not only our donors, but more importantly, our repositories. I don't want to find myself in a position in a courtroom in front of a prosecutor and a judge saying that we implemented MPLP as our processing strategy and that Mark Green and Dennis Meisner said that the legal risk was minimal, and having them look at me and say, we don't care what Mark Green and Dennis Meisner said. You're here, and they're not. And this is the law. So we have a responsibility not only to protect our donors when possible, but also our institutions where we work. We're getting paid to do a job. And it's not just processing collections, removing staples or paper clips. It's also to look out for the institution's welfare. That's part of why we get paid. The second part about our profession. when cutbacks occur, I've never seen an administrator tear down a building. It's always vacant positions go unfilled, or people are let go, furloughed. For an administrator, the budget is the bottom line. And if MPLP is your institution's processing strategy, and that administrator knows that he or she or someone can train two students to do an MPLP processing procedure or use MPLP as their processing methodology, then why do they need to spend $40,000 employing a full-time professional archivist? I think it's that kind of implication at MPLP down the road. It's not happening right now, but down the road, this is what we're facing, I think.
Lori, did you have a comment?
Yeah. To the point about intellectual work coming in and making MPLP decisions and prioritization, that is true. A lot of intellectual work would go into that. But to the point about processing over and over again, it takes an amazing amount of intellectual work to do complicated arrangements and to write very complicated descriptions of these rather complicated sets of folder topics. So I agree with them, but it's not just processing over and over again. Every collection is incredibly different, and perhaps I deal with more complicated things with political papers. But
okay. Let's have another question. A young man here in front. I'll have to repeat for him. Okay, I'll try to summarize that. You're with IMF, International Monetary Fund. He has around 70 million digital collections, digital documents, and his concern is that this does not really work for digital collections that are this large, and he would like some feedback about how it might work for that, or how it might could be applied. Is that correct? He wants to know how MPLP might could be applied to that. So, no, that's the other way around. I'm sorry. It's hard to hear. Okay. Okay, Dennis.
Yeah.
No. Hey, you guys go.
Okay. I would say, again, just as in the analog world, there are no ideal outcomes through applying minimal digitization techniques, but they are there. They are, in fact, being experimented with, at least. And one person who's doing that experimenting is Joshua Ranger at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh, who is taking entire manuscript collections, digitizing the materials in each folder, I think just as JPEGs, one after the other, no metadata. So you have the file titles linked to a digital folder that just has this long set of items that are not individually described. So the researcher essentially is in the same position as going through a folder of analog paper items, and bears the same costs and time investment and interpreting the materials, because they're not pre-interpreted for them. But it is a level of adequacy.
One thing I did want to mention, it's kind of in relation to that, but a researcher's most valuable commodity is time. Now, I deal with congressional and collections and public policy collections, so generally my researchers may be different than yours. I'm generally dealing with academic researchers. They have other jobs. They teach 9 months out of the year. They have 3 months in the summer to do their research. They're not going to thank me if they come to my repository and I give them 20 or 30 boxes of minimally processed material with the finding aid is not all that helpful. They simply don't have time to dig through that and do my work for me. They have limited resources. So trust me, they're going to go to a repository that has a decent finding aid where they can both maximize their time and their resources. But I think the same principle applies. This is probably actually another discussion. You know, how do you make a digital collection that large available to researchers to begin with? I haven't even tried to wrap my head around that one yet.
Okay, he's saying that basically MPLP is the only option he has. And while in the context of paper records we're talking about ethics and other things, he's still feeling that he has no other option but what MPLP offers. Have I summed that up? Okay. I really wish we had another 30 minutes for discussion, but as you know, we only had 1 hour for this session. If you want to stay a minute, we'll take one more question. If not, I'll try to wrap up very quickly. Does anyone have a burning question? Go ahead.
Agreed. Everyone should reread MPLP. I'm more against the across-the-board application of a component of MPLP, of the minimal processing aspect. Certainly there are times I do it. I process some series in really large collections to a more minimal level, and some I have to handle every item. We've just seen in some conferences people applying it across the board and not making those decisions of which you talk about.
And one comment I would like to make on that is one concern I've had is that people who perhaps don't have a great deal of processing experience to be familiar with some of these collections, and I'm thinking especially of congressional collections, which is my experience, there are a lot of gray areas there. It's not just a black-white sort of decision-making thing. And if they're in a shop that perhaps has only one or two congressional collections, there's no one there who's really had experience. They're the first one there working with them. And if they just applied MPLP without really any background or some consultation or whatever, I think there could be problems down the road. So that's one thing I would be concerned about, just from my personal experience. Where I am, we definitely are interested in MPLP and what it can do for us. We had already been talking about streamlined processing, and this gives us some good guidelines for it. But then I have the other concerns as well. So if I can conclude here, because I know there's another session coming up, I think one of the true values of MPLP is that at a time when technology is really bringing forth new opportunities for providing description and access, MPLP has put processing heretofore our most basic and perhaps least discussed responsibility, has put it into the forefront of professional discussion. And I think this is really good. I think the question is, where do we go from here? It's obvious we need a balance in what we do with MPLP. For example, it saves money by not having to buy boxes and folders and being fiscally responsible. But at the same time, if we weed a lot of material, which we can do in congressional collections, a lot of duplicates are just in, they're segregated. And so it's very easy to, you know, find those and remove them, and that gives us more shelf space, which we all need. So I think it's that continuum of decision making, which this gentleman was saying over here, that we have to apply as well. So this, in the article, MPLP was set forth as guidelines. I think one thing we need to ask our co-authors is, are they interested in having these come forward as standards for SAA? Dennis, perhaps you want to address that quickly.
Yeah. This is a good summation, I guess, for me. I hope that these minimal processing guidelines never become a standard in the sense that it's the way to do it. This is one arrow in a very large quiver, and I hope we're always willing to pull out every arrow that's there and look at it and see if it matches up better with the job at hand. I hope that the MPLP principles continue to be looked at as a useful good practice and a very sustainable practice, but I don't want them bronzed and put on a shelf for everyone to, I don't want it to be a litmus test. And I think that there is some danger that some people are looking at it as a litmus test for how valid their own practices are. So.
Okay. Well, we still have a question. We'll take it. This was Jan Zastrow from the University of Hawaii, and she was saying that we should let the researchers know before coming that the collection is minimally processed, the same way as we might say a collection is unprocessed, so they know what to expect when they come in terms of what time it will take for them, and that relieves some of the negative impact that it might have otherwise. So in summation, I think that what we probably still would need here is more discussion. It seems to me that there needs to be a discussion at a more advanced level now that some people are applying it. Some people have questions. And to inform more of our profession about the gray areas of this processing strategy. I appreciate your coming. I appreciate your wanting to stay overtime. I think it does show that there's great interest in this collection. I wish, in this subject, and I wish we had had more time for discussion. Thank you.